The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay. All right, so I see some people I know, some people I don't. So hi to those I don't know. Nice to meet you. I teach on Thursday nights, Dharma Practice Thursdays at 6:30. So come by sometime if you like to connect. We do small group discussions, and you get to another way to get to know your sangha. It's a nice evening. And I'm a student of Gil and Andrea, Gil Fronstall and Andrea Fella, and I'm in the 4-year teacher training program that's going on. We're just finishing year 3, so I am a student and child of Dharma at IMC. This is my Dharma home. And Martha, I appreciate you bringing up the center being Dana-based. I was kind of just feeling a sense of awe and wonder this morning, yesterday, as I was thinking about coming to teach today, because I didn't have to tell anybody I was coming. I didn't have to arrange a place to offer the teachings. I didn't have to pay for anything. All this stuff I didn't have to do because of the way the center, everything is freely offered. So, Martha, right? Thank you. And
Vanky.
Thank you, right? And Hillary out there, thank you. And
the tea folks,
and who else? You know, going, organizing walks, everything here. Absolutely. The paint on the wall. Seriously, the car, all of it is Dana. The building itself is Dana. Out of generosity, because the people before us wanted us here. They wanted you here. So I'm grateful to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, including this Sangha, right? So what I want to talk about today is reactivity and non-reactivity. This is a big topic, and it's tied to a lot in the Dharma. But, you know, reactivity is a pretty unpleasant thing, isn't it? Really uncomfortable. And, I feel very yanked around when I'm being reactive. And, I'm inevitably walking away feeling remorseful, regretful, you know, when I've been reactive. Like, why couldn't I just be still? Why couldn't I just meet this moment without adding all this flopping around? And really, this is why I came to the practice, was because I was not able to meet what was happening in my life. It was too hard. Things were falling apart. And I kept, you know, it was just too painful. I kept reacting and reacting and reacting. So I wasn't able to, there's so much I wasn't able to meet. And I kept trying, and I'd say, okay, I want to do this. I want to be able to calm and talk about this or respond kindly. But it was just, the feelings inside were just so intense. And, that was true. One of the relationships in my life that's really motivated me to practice is my relationship with my kids. And it's really important to me. I want to be a good mom. I wanted to be a mom that could meet her kid or kids where they were, to make them feel, you know, like I trusted them, I believed in them. And I kept failing because my reactivity would get in the way of the message I was trying to deliver. So when I finally came to the practice because of so much reactivity, I was pretty darn motivated. And I kind of just dove right in and was on retreats almost right away. And I just, over and over again. It was just like, there's a way. There's another way to meet this life. There's another way. I was recently thinking about this, and I was remembering an image that I had, you know, been taught from one of the suttas early in my practice. And the image was of a fish flopping around. Doesn't that just sound like reactivity? Like a fish flopping around on the ground in a puddle or, you know, like that. And that is exactly what, for me, I felt inside of myself. Was like this fish that was just relentlessly flopping around. And so I looked up the sutta again recently, and I'm going to share it with you. The sutta, you know, the Buddha does an amazing job of providing these similes, these images, these metaphors, analogies for what we experience in our inner life. And, you know, this is an example of one of those, you know, analogies or similes that has just really stayed with me. And there's something so visceral about it. And so for me, the practice is an experience to have, to engage with. So these kinds of similes are really helpful because when I feel it, I'm reminded of the Dharma. So may this sutta be there inside of you, deeply connected to whatever your version of a fish flopping around is, you know? Yeah?
Put your mic closer because I'm not able to amplify for the internet folks.
Can I adjust it for
sure.
Okay.
All that. Is that any better? Doesn't sound any better to me.
Not crazy. It's still a little far.
How's that? That's oh, that felt better, right? Yeah, okay. Okay. So the sutta is called the Atanda Sutta, and it's been interpreted by a number of Pali scholars. Some call it the rod embraced. Some call it arming oneself. Another name is the thorn in your heart. And this is a sutta that the Buddha gives when he's called to deal with a conflict in community. And he shares a lot about his own emotional response to conflict in this sutta. It's really quite touching. And while the sutta is about external conflict, right, between people, I invite you to feel into this as the same as internal conflict. And by that I mean we can take up arms against others, but we also take them up against ourselves. And we might not take up physical arms against others, but if we take up arms in my mind about somebody, if I'm angry at somebody, we have an internal experience that results in suffering. If I think about myself critically, there's a way in which my experience of this is that then my image of myself becomes akin to an enemy. That when I think about myself, my physiology responds to myself as if I am a threat. My very own self, because of my own view of myself in some circumstance. So please don't limit yourself to thinking about this as only about those other people who fight with other people. If there's any degree of inner conflict, inner criticism, if you have an inner critic, which I imagine you all do, this applies to you. When embraced, so let me just, I should say this first too. There's so many translations. I have a number of different them that are mixed together here. So if you go to look up the sutta, you may find a different version, or you'll see that I've mixed versions together here. When embraced, the rod of violence breeds danger and fear. Fear is born from arming oneself. Just see how many people fight. I'll tell you about the dreadful fear that caused me to shake all over. This is the Buddha speaking. I'll tell you about the dreadful fear that caused me to shake all over. Seeing creatures flopping around like fish in shallow and water too shallow, so hostile to one another, seeing this, I became afraid. Another translation of that little two lines is, I saw this population flounder like fish in a little puddle. Seeing them fight each other, fear came upon me. The world around was hollow. All directions were in turmoil. Wanting a home for myself, I saw nowhere. He also says in another translation, it trembles in all directions, this world. Seeing people locked in conflict, I became completely distraught. Who here has felt distraught seeing the conflict in the world? Yeah, me too. I longed to find myself a place unscathed, but I could not see it. Seeing people locked in conflict, I became completely distraught, but then I discern here a thorn, hard to see, lodged deep in the heart. What does this bring up for you, this idea of a thorn in the heart? Typically, it's greed, hatred, and delusion, right? It's craving, clinging. It is only when pierced by this thorn that one runs in all directions, right? When we are, you know, really in the grip, when we're not in the grip, we don't run in all directions. And if that thorn is taken out, one does not run and settles down. There's another translation of, when struck by that dart, you run around in all directions. And I like the dart image because it reminds me of the arrow simile. But when that same dart has been plucked out, you neither run around nor sink down. And I like that too. Run around at or sink down. Because I have seen this too, where there's this running around reactivity, and you know, that is acting out and trying to escape and all these things. And then there's a giving up or giving in that is like a sinking down. Like just a complete kind of sunken place. It can happen. The one title of this is The Rod Embraced, and the rod symbolizes taking up arms, right? Usually back then it was a stick. But the simile should be understood to understand that the rod of violence has three forms: physical, verbal, and mental. So this goes to the words that we use toward others, ourselves, the way we treat ourselves physically, the way we treat others physically, and the way we imagine things, the way we think of things, the views and opinions we create. And one interpreter says the cause of this is the misplaced wish for security, driven by desire. And the sutta goes on to talk about the solution, which is all the ways we learn to let go in this practice. All the ways we learn to let go. And, you know, these are pretty common things that you'll hear. And I'll just say a little bit about them, but a sage should be truthful, overcome greed, overcome the hindrances, essentially sloth and torpor, and among others. Should not sink into false speech. Should understand greed as a great deluge. Staying close to the truth, develop wisdom, and transcend this desire for sensual pleasure, letting what is gone be gone. Being free of cruelty. And not seeing oneself as any of the following. Not seeing oneself as equal. Welcome back, baby. I love the sound meditation this morning. So sweet. So we don't see ourselves as equal, inferior, or superior. Is that hard to imagine? What's that?
Well, how do we then? What is the...
Yeah.
You know, I have something that I learned from psychology, but I've never heard anything from the Buddhist perspective
before. Yeah. Well, I can tell you how I interpret it. Jeannie, thank you. So I think that, I mean, our language, this language to me is quite binary. It's very, you know, one way or another. We're, you know, this or that. And when we think about equality or equal, being equal, if we think about ourselves, then, you know, when we want somebody else to be equal to it, there's a real math equation here. Right, there's this like sense of you can weigh two things on the scale and they weigh the same. But they don't. We don't weigh the same. Our experiences can't be commodified in that way. So if we can go beyond this idea of mathematical equations and we can just think about the uniqueness of each being, that there's no way to measure, you know, this equality thing. Not that one is more important or less important. Both are important. And if we can see people as unique, as special, as kind of whatever it is they are, we're going to be much more inclined to be curious about what does make you you? And what does make me me? So is that helpful, Jeannie?
Yeah.
Great. I'm glad. So, I think that one of the teachings I grabbed onto when I was more reactive more often, maybe than I am now, was just don't make it worse. It's a really, really good teaching. Just don't make it worse. And I remember, you know, hearing the teachers talk about to try and sit and be with whatever came up, right? Like, turn towards your experience with curiosity. You know, don't try and change it. Be with your suffering. And when I was first practicing, I couldn't even be with my own mind for more than 5 minutes. It was like 5 minutes was the time. That was the minimum, you know, that was the marker. Okay, sit for five, Tanya. Try and sit. And I believe it was hard to sit still. It was hard to sit with what was coming up in my own mind and not be flopping around like a fish. I wanted to get away from what I was feeling. I wanted to feel calm. I wanted to be at ease. I wanted to be happy. I was not. It was hard. So the idea of not making it worse was like, okay, can I just, you know, if I'm reactive this much, can I just not make it worse, not be more reactive, right? And not react to my reactivity. But the words, while I couldn't quite do them, did wake something up in me. And then this vision, this idea of this fish came alive in me. And I started to feel the fish more and more. And I could feel the fish as something. Something that was going on in me. It was, instead of it just being everything, a feeling in my mind and my thoughts being everything, my whole experience, I could start to see, oh, this is something that's going on inside, and then there's reactivity to it. I'll come back to this, but I just want to say that it is really hard to listen, to be receptive, and impossible to love when we are flopping around like fish. When we are trying to escape from what we're feeling, what's happening, we cannot love. Because our attention, our energy is fully consumed with trying to get away, trying to change it. And sometimes in life we're asked to sit through things that are hideously difficult. And I want to love through those things too. I really do. I'm just giving my heart a minute here. Baba, yeah. You know, one of the crown jewels of the practice of the teachings is developing wisdom, understanding this heart-mind complex. Yep. So understanding what's happening will bring peace to the mind. And once you understand how precious the process is of being able to look and see and understand from the perspective of what the Buddha teaches us, joy becomes more possible, and we feel more and more motivated to keep looking. So coming to understand what's happening inside of us with this fish wiggling around, jiggling around, trying to get air. Maybe the simplest way to understand it, and if you were here the last time I spoke, you know a lot about how I feel about dukkha. I gave a talk a couple months ago called Becoming a Dukkha Tracker. So if you're interested in hearing more from me about dukkha, listen to the talk. So dukkha, what is dukkha? For those of you who don't know, dukkha is the Pali word for suffering. So it is said, the Buddha said, he taught suffering and the end of suffering. The whole continuum. And so suffering can be translated in this huge range from very subtle, like just the slightest, fabric that rubs a little bit on your skin, creates a little bit of tenderness maybe, just a little bit of a rub, to maybe this idea of fish flopping around in a war. Huge amounts of suffering and pain. So this great big scale. So this is dukkha. And I like to use the word dukkha because it has a different context for me than the word suffering, which I don't really like, maybe because I don't like to suffer. But there's also a couple other translations that can be useful. One is stress. Right? Another is pain, which I like too. And then one teacher, Lee Brasington, suggested the term bummer, which I happen to love because it communicates our attitude toward the suffering. So when you find yourself, that's a bummer. Oh, I'm clinging. There's something here I don't like, right? It's also described, the cause, right? The cause of dukkha is clinging. So for me, I'll just say quickly, dukkha itself is not really, for me, I am so grateful for my dukkha. I am incredibly grateful for my dukkha. And in fact, I was thinking this morning, wow, who am I to think that I should take anyone's dukkha away? Who am I? I needed my dukkha. I have needed that stress, that suffering, that pain, that to wake me up to what I've been clinging to. So, may I let you all have your dukkha. So the cause of dukkha is something that is incredibly helpful to understand. So speaking of growing wisdom, we grow wisdom when we start to understand that dukkha itself is, for me, a guide. Dukkha itself is pointing to the fact that I'm clinging. It is a symptom of clinging. When I cling, it hurts. So if I can see dukkha when I feel that pain, that hurt, the discomfort, the stress, I can stop and look in the mind, heart, body, to ask myself, what do I want to be different right now? What am I clinging to? What is going on here? What is it, a view I have, an opinion I have, a belief I have? And what's going on? And the Buddha taught, in one of his teachings, three kinds of clinging. So I'll just name them to help us, because it's helpful, right, to sort of look, oh, there's sense clinging to sensuality, feeling good, food tasting good, like, oh, bummer, this dinner sucks. Okay, clinging to wanting it to taste better, right? Very simple. Probably not a huge amount of dukkha in that, unless maybe, you're serving the Dalai Lama or something. there's a natural, amount of wanting to be comfortable. It's really okay. It's really okay that we want pleasant things and we want to feel okay and not be in pain. It's really fine. I was thinking about babies, probably inspired by our guest, and about how from birth, you know, babies know what they want and what they don't want. They go toward what they want and they cry and push away what they don't want. Like, this is just part of being a human, an animal even, right? Living, all living, even an amoeba, you know? Like, we all go toward what feels good. So, you know, okay, we're human beings. We're living beings. This is how we survive. This is how we get through life. So clinging to sensuality, wanting to feel pleasure, wanting to enjoy life and feel good, welcome to the world, right? It's when we start to really cling, we get in trouble. The other is clinging to becoming. What does this mean, clinging to becoming? It's sort of like, I want to become, you know, a world athletic Olympic swimmer at 56, right? How likely is that to happen? Not at all. But I have this vision, this wish. I wish I could be this. And we imagine it and we fantasize it and we get kind of caught up in this idea of becoming something. And it triggers a lot of mental kind of fabrication, a lot of story making. I want to be this. There's a lot of clinging that can get going in this. And the opposite of wanting to become is clinging to non-becoming. And this is really painful. If you have social anxiety, you go into a room and you want to disappear. You don't want to be there, or you feel suicidal. You don't want to be alive anymore. This is clinging to non-becoming, not wanting to be, not wanting to be the person that makes this mistake or does that thing or isn't this, right? So these are three of the ways that we can look for how we might be clinging. So this is not to say that I shouldn't want to become a great swimmer. It's not to say you shouldn't want to become a great meditator or a good Buddhist or whatever it is you want to become. Keep your desires, get rid of your cravings. Hold it all lightly. There's a way in which, in the Pali Canon, in the Buddhist teaching, there are a lot of analogies that talk about this paradox of, you know, don't cling, don't have desire, you know, don't get caught up in sensual desire. But we need to have our desire. We need to want to do things. The baby needs to want to eat, right? It's okay. And one of them is this teaching on the raft. The Buddha talks about building a raft to cross the floods of greed, hatred, and delusion, to get from the shore of suffering to the shore free of suffering. I want to be over there. But to get there, we have to get ourselves across. And essentially, my view of it is we build this through creating a mental state that allows us to stay present, aware, non-reactive, to put enough energy into getting across, to have clarity. And we cross the stream. And then he says, when you get to the other side, what do you do with the raft that you use to get across? Do you put it on your head and carry it around with you everywhere you go? No, you leave it on the shore. Because you've crossed over. You used something to get where you need to go. Well, the same is true with, you know, the desires that we hold. We need them. To want to meditate, we need to want to meditate, right? It takes commitment and effort and some hope, some faith, hopefully confidence, to do this practice. It's not an easy practice. There's a Rumi quote, "The hurt you embrace becomes joy. Call it to your arms where it can change." Isn't that sweet? Yeah, I'll read you the whole poem. It's a couple lines longer than that. "The hurt you embrace becomes joy. Call it to your arms where it can change. A silkworm eating leaves makes a cocoon. Each of us weaves a chamber of leaves and sticks. Silkworms begin to truly exist as they disappear inside that room. Without legs, we fly. The hurt you embrace becomes joy. Call it to your arms where it can change." Gil will talk about practicing with open hands, allowing whatever it is that we're working with space, like a bird, you know, letting it sit here, and then when it's ready to go, it goes. And we're not holding on to it and trying to keep it, but we're giving it this nurturing space to come in and do what it needs to do and transform on its own. So when we stop fighting the way things are, we have access to love, to joy. When we block parts of our experience, when we try and resist difficult emotions or difficult experiences that are happening, we end up blocking both the difficult and the beautiful. The joy and the anger. So when we stop fighting the way things are, we have access to love. Pema Chodron says, "Fear is a universal experience. Even the smallest insect feels it. We wade into tidal pools and put our finger near the soft, open bodies of sea anemones, and they close up. Everything spontaneously does that. It's not a terrible thing that we feel fear when we're faced with the unknown. It's part of being alive, something we all share. Fear is a natural response to moving closer to the truth." And she goes on to say, "Embarking on the spiritual journey is like getting into a very small boat and setting out on the ocean to search for unknown lands. With wholehearted practice comes inspiration, but sooner or later, we will also encounter fear. For all we know, when we get to the horizon, we are going to drop off the edge of the world." No wonder there people thought the world was flat, right? Like, oh, yeah, if you're venturing off and you really have no idea, you're probably afraid you're going to fall off. Oh, that's how that idea came about. "Like all explorers, we are drawn to discover what's waiting out there, yet not knowing if we have the courage to face it." And this is big. There's 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows in this life. We can't block the sorrows without blocking the joys. We don't get to just have the joys. It is a crazy-ass ride out there. Yeah. We're just depriving ourselves, really, if we try and control it. It's not possible anyway. So how do we just sit down and buckle up? Put that resolve, take resolve to just be there and open to what's happening in our lives, even when it's not what we want, even when it's what we're terrified of. Who am I to take away somebody's suffering? Who am I to take away that which could liberate someone if they have wisdom? "The moment you accept what troubles you've been given, the door will open. This is more roomy. Welcome difficulty as a familiar comrade. Comrade. Joke with torment brought by the friend. Sorrows are the rags of clothes and jackets that serve to cover. Then are taken off. That undressing and the beautiful naked body underneath is the sweetness that comes after grief. The hurt you embrace becomes joy. Maybe we can learn the value of staying present, engaged, and available to life. We can learn how to welcome more and more aspects of life, the beautiful and the difficult. And this is how we don't make it worse. This is how, minute by minute, moment by moment, just don't make it worse. There's time for one last poem, maybe, if you can hang in there. This is by Rosemary Wahola Traumer. It's called Skiing into the Storm. I love the days when it feels right not to turn from the storm, but to move deeper in. When the body doesn't shy from the cold and wind. When the smile arrives as the storm magnifies and a whoop rises from the lungs like a fierce and hardy bird. What is it in us that feels more alive in these moments? Thank you for your kind attention.